Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Billboard on Broadway podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Milzoff, deputy features editor at Billboard and Broadway fan and expert here. I've been away for a little bit, but I'm back. Have no fear. So if you listen to the podcast, you know that one of the many recurring subjects as musical theater composers go is Stephen Sondheim. Sondheim is pretty much considered the most brilliant writer of modern musical theater, the sort of god of modern musical theater. He wrote the music and lyrics for shows like Into the Woods, Company, Follies, Sunday in the Park with George, Sweeney Todd, to name just a few. And all of those shows exemplify what many people, I would say even and especially people who insist that they do not like musicals, love most about Sondheim. His music has complexity and depth. His shows have a really dry and often kind of dark sense of wit, maybe even cynicism in some cases. They're always thought-provoking and feel refreshing in the larger world of musical theater, which sometimes romance can feel like it replaces realism in musicals. But I think the reason Sondheim scores are so incredibly powerful is that to balance all of that, he has a lot of soul as well. There is a kind of underlying sense of longing that really feels intrinsic to what it means to be human that's present on all of the stories and music that he writes. That element of his music is what stood out most to me on a new album called Sondheim Sublime by my guest today, Melissa Errico. Melissa is a longtime favorite of Broadway fans. She's definitely one of the most beautifully classically voiced sopranos around. She starred in major roles in classic musicals like My Fair Lady and Finian's Rainbow, along with the original productions of new musicals like Amour and Anna Karenina. And I actually had the pleasure of seeing her in a great production of Sondheim's Passion a few years ago here in New York. So I was excited to talk to her about that, along with why she made this Sondheim album at this point in her very varied career, for this week's episode.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Send in the clown.
Well, the first thing I want to ask you about is, I mean, I feel like making a Sondheim album is something that I'd imagine any actor dreams of doing at some point. But I would also think that it's not something you take lightly or you do at just any point in your career. So I want to know, why was now the moment for you to do a Sondheim album?
Well, the real impetus for doing this, though I wasn't thinking I would discuss this and so on, was, and to put you out of any suspense that I will create right away, I had gotten some bad health news about 18 months ago. And at the same time as being asked to do a concert at 54 Below on a Saturday night, I said, yeah, I'll do a concert. I was getting some bad news that was about my health. I had a cyst and I had a tumor. And I was thinking to myself, well, my doctor said, you're fine. You're probably fine. Keep going. And I said, so concurrently with my life, I had an opportunity to do a concert. And I, when faced with a complicated and humbling moment, I thought to myself, I'll do, you know, I said to the booker, I said, I'll do a Sondheim concert. And the more that I prepared the Sondheim concert, the more I was drawn to the ideas in Sondheim that I thought would last forever. And so I'm well. I had surgeries and so on, and it was not cancer, but it was something called a neuroendocrinal tumor, which is not good, and it was taken out. And so for many months, I worked on this music and didn't quite know where I stood. So to give you an absolutely honest answer, which I haven't told anyone before, this music came out of the most profound emotions. I've been in the show business for 30 years, and I learned so much from studying Sondheim's music in the light of something scary. Mm-hmm. And the idea of the sublime, the title is called Sondheim Sublime, came out of my art history background. I was a Yale student, and I was very involved in the art history major that I had and philosophy major. But the idea of the sublime is a really popular idea in religion, in philosophy, and in art history. And it is the concept, is a romantic pictures, it's the concept of beautiful things that are terrifying.
Hmm.
It's the marriage of beauty and terror. And as I looked at Sondheim, I saw that everywhere.
Completely.
Everything to do with marriage, everything to do with love and making children, making art, the risks of making art, the costs, and sex. It occurs often in sexy, sexy, sexy songs. People want pleasure in Sondheim, but they want pleasure in the light of the idea that time is running out.
Hmm.
How much pleasure can we get out of life before time runs out? Some people said, oh, you should sing in Buddy's Eyes. And I thought, you know what? No, that's not Melissa. I want something sexier than that. And about children and creation and carrying on and hope and the wounds, you know, of our lives and so on. So it came out of a really profound impulse. The only reason I gave you such an honest answer is because that was such a strong question. Why Sondheim? And in light of my awe of all the actors who've done it before me, I had a really honest impulse. And I have 30 years of being an actor to bring to it. So I thought, well, why not now?
Well, I was going to say that that's as profound a description of what the essence of Sondheim is as I've heard. Very glad you're well, by the way.
Thank you.
And, you know, I think that what stands out to me listening to it is really that you're taking a very, I don't want to say plain spoken, but kind of a very just like straight ahead approach to it. It's not about drama and artifice. Like, it really feels like it's about just acting the words of the songs and letting them, you know, speak, which they do beautifully.
Strangely, it's the deepest letter I've ever written.
Yeah.
You know, from my soul. And I didn't want to try to sell it. I was very conscious to just try. Well, actually, I wasn't conscious of it. It really is how I sing. You know, if you look at all the albums I've ever made, I've always been a person who took recording work seriously. And I've worked with some of the best people in the world, including now Rob Mathis, this terrific producer who works with Sting and, you know, Eric Clapton and Elvis Costello right now and all these people. I have wonderful background in making records. But this record was meant to not be a piece only of theater, but a piece of soulful music. You know, mm-hmm. So I'm glad you feel that.
And I think that, I mean, I'm not the first person to say this about the overall feel of the album, but I think that it is not the traditional approach to Sondheim to focus on the real kind of soul and passion and the idea of wanting that is so mm-hmm. central to his songs, and not to focus on like the witticisms and the cynicisms. And that is what, you know, I think, as I just said in my intro, draws so many people who are self-professed not musical theater fans to even like Sondheim.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you zero in on that? Was that like the accumulation of life experience doing his shows, or something that just came to you in this particular moment?
Well, I think that, you know, this album, as well as being something that was a personal necessity, as it were, you know, similar to all the words of Sunday in the Park with George, that you have to keep creating. Anything you do, let it come from you. Give us more to see. All these things that are crucial to being creative people. And I'm in my midlife here. You know, I'm in my 40s and I have children, and I have to keep looking at the impulse to want to create and not let myself get discouraged by time and the confusions of getting older and so on. So I had my own personal impulse. But also, I think 2018 is a really difficult year. I think it's a difficult time in history for everyone. I think this Me Too movement was also happening at the same time. I think it brought up a lot of pain for a lot of women. And I thought in this industry, there's a lot of issues about being heard, what you're really thinking, the idea of secrets, people having secrets. And I think Sondheim, a lot of his characters are have a lot of secrets and secret longings and so on. So I also just think I wanted to make a record that I thought was appropriate for our time, where so many things are in doubt, from our democracy to our jobs, our women's sense of worth, a lot of people's senses of worth, you know. So I tried also to make an album for, you know, for people who are out there and what I think they're going through, you know. So I did not choose the terribly clever side of Sondheim. But if you look at Sondheim as a clever guy and a piece of New York City, what is the best thing about New York City? And that is, if he's one of the ultimate sort of New York Jewish intellectuals of New York City, cosmopolitanism. All people are welcome here, all shapes and sizes and nationalities. The cosmopolitanism of Sondheim himself, though he wouldn't say he's an activist, I imagine, is a kind of activism. The island of the Grand Jatte, which is the island of Sunday in the Park with George, is a place where people from all walks of life and all ages and economic, you know, just it's a place where all people are calmly spending an afternoon peacefully in harmony on the island. And I think in the strangest sense, I hope you feel that in my record, my wish, you know, for what's super going wrong right now in our world.
Well, it's definitely comforting to hear as well.
Yeah. So I tried to bring out the Sondheim I think we need right now. If you want, I could do volume two. I could be super nasty. And you know, like maybe things will look up and I'll wear, you know, some sassy, you know, outfit and just sass for volume two or volume three. But the first one's sublime. Then we could do Sondheim sass, and then we could do Sondheim. You can name it. You're smart.
Yes. So. Well, I like Sondheim sass. I would listen to that.
Okay. So we'll do that for volume two. But for this one, this is how I wanted to begin, both because I was humbled and sort of enlightened by, you know, my own fears and myself, and also looking at a world where so many people are being humbled and, you know, are living in doubt. So, you know, it is what it is. And I certainly also I never wanted to choose his super dreary songs. I don't think this is dreary. It's sensual, really, in a way, you know. So
you've had various and diverse Sondheim roles over your career, and I wondered if you remember your first ever Sondheim role and what that was like.
This is going to be the most confessional podcast that ever happened at Billboard. I had a really strange idea in doing Sunday in the Park with George, which was my first show, and I hadn't met him yet, about the competition between Dot and George, the competition for how to spend your time. And George wants to spend his time finishing a hat and working. And she wants to be touched, and she wants to live life, and she wants to take at least some time to go to the Follies, for example. And there's that wonderful and long, difficult to sing sequence called Color and Light. He is painting furiously with insane focus. And she is getting ready to go to the Follies. Bernadette Peters famously at the makeup table with her adorable pantaloons and getting her makeup done. And she can't wait. She's all fidgety and can't wait to go on a date. And he decides at the very end they're not going on the date. He has to finish the hat. And this sort of competition between a man and a woman for the night. And I thought to myself, well, if I really wanted to get my man off the ladder and off the pointillistic canvas, I'd take all my clothes off. And I said, but then some of the lyrics wouldn't make sense. And so I had this idea, came right into rehearsal, and I was like, I want to be naked. And it was the first major revival. And so it required some discussion about if that's possible and how do you do completely in a bathtub. I said, you know, using my art history background, I was able to say all these ateliers had no walls and they would have a bathtub in the middle of the room and that'd be completely fine. She could be in the tub, he could be painting, and he'd be looking at her and getting more and more nervous and more focused and rejecting her nubile or beautiful, very impressionistic bather, which is completely appropriate as well. So Sondheim had to write new lyrics. And so that's my first memory, was being so young and so brazen as to ask for changes on the first day. I would never do that now. But that's what a young person does. They go like, oh, hi, you're Mr. Sondheim. How do you do? Yes. I have this idea, you see. It just means you have to change. He changed some lyrics. He put it's on YouTube, the new lyrics. It's something about scent and soap. And so as I was bathing, I wasn't saying rouge in the colors I was painting. I was painting the smells and scents.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So my memory of the first production was the naiveness of somebody like, you know, me, who just didn't realize you don't go up to a genius and promote ideas of change on day one. But he was great. So it was great. And Raoul and I still think it was a highlight of our careers, you know, to date.
Oh, yeah, I wish I had seen that. Well, it
really
mean, it also
fun.
Speaks to, as you said, that he's open-minded. He doesn't see his work as just completely set in stone.
No.
I feel like recently hearing about this gender reverse company in London, which
very,
I would love to see. Like,
he's very
he's
interested
open to
in
art
it.
Evolving.
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Sondheim is very excited about we write to each other, and he is extremely...
What? Like,
oh,
rewind.
Yeah. I have a long correspondence with him this whole time. This year and a half has been amazing. It'd be like pen pals in the old days.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of
oh
writing,
my God.
A lot of writing back and forth, and a lot of advice and chastisements as well, you know, when he wants to steer me. He thinks teaching is the highest profession, the highest calling.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very, I think maybe this year, one of my latest thoughts to him was that I think his sensitivity to the experience of being a woman might be much on his mind because of company. I think he's had to rethink what women think, what they're thinking, and see Bobby through that lens. And he does it so well. And he's been so compassionate to me. So,
well, I mean, I think that, you know, when I think of Sunday in the Park with George and Do I Hear a Waltz and I Saw You in Passion, which was amazing production. I mean, even just those three, there's such diversity in the women you're playing. And I think that Sondheim does write some of the most complex women in musical
Absolutely.
Theater.
Oh, and there's so many I hope to come. Knock on wood. I mean, this just it is Camp Sondheim. You know, if there was something called Camp Sondheim, I would sign up.
I would go to.
And I would go in the woods and just be in Camp Sondheim. I would pack my duffel bag and my water bottle that says Camp Sondheim, and I'm not coming back.
Oh my God. I would now
You'd
I,
come?
I need
so
that to exist now. What else would Camp Sondheim involve?
What would it involve?
Vodka, like vodka stingers, obviously.
Oh, yeah, we could drink. We could drink and cry and sing.
A lot of
and
drinking and crying
making
and like exchanging
things.
Of sexual partners, yeah. I feel.
Oh, this is great. We have an independent movie to make now.
Yes,
I see it.
This is an excellent idea.
Yeah.
I was going to ask later, but what are your dream Sondheim roles for this next kind of stage of your career? Like, what would you love to do?
Well, I think the one that's glaringly on my obvious in some ways, I hope, or just I would love to do A Little Night Music.
Mm-hmm.
I sing Send in the Clowns on this album. And, you know, Send in the Clowns was the biggest challenge to record, because if you go on YouTube, you know, you'll hear every Scandinavian choir and every, you know, Israeli pop singer. And everyone has sung Send in the Clowns. And it's daunting to take on the song as a piece of recording, never mind the character in a play. But I just tried in that way to explore what it would be like to play Desiree. I just thought on my record, in some cases, I reinvent the songs or rethink them, as you'll see if you listen.
Mm-hmm.
But in that case of Send in the Clowns, I just went right back to a woman in her 40s who's an actress who gave up her entire life for her career, which, of course, is something I have not done. And but I can imagine what it would be like if I had. And now she's come to a point in her life where she really wants this man, and she wants to marry him, and she wants to have a life, this man she's always loved, and it's not going to happen. So it's what a wonderful piece of acting that song is, you know, the humiliation and the that's the embarrassment and the disappointment that she feels, but then she covers it up with all the terms of a performer's life, you know, farce and making entrances and exits,
mm-hmm.
all for this career. And she has to face, you know, that she'll probably have to take all this on to the next play. You
mm-hmm.
know, do you remember Noel Coward's song, If Love Were All?
I don't think
Hey
I
Ho, If Love Were All. It's all about one's talent to amuse. And so an actress is sometimes that's all you end up with is the talent to amuse.
Hmm.
And that's life. That is the substance of to do one thing may preclude the other. And that is a really agonizing and interesting idea.
Yeah, that's a really heartbreaking
It's really heartbreaking. So I would love to, you know, explore Desiree in those terms. the talent to amuse and the losses that you know occur after that.
I feel like this can happen. I feel like yeah. This could be in the cards.
Do you have any friends?
Yes.
Tell someone at Billboard.
Yes. It doesn't seem so out of the cards.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I was interested too by the fact that you're singing a couple of songs on the record that are written for men, but are not songs that I think of as, well, a man has to sing this, like No More, Marry Me a Little. How did you approach those songs that were not originally written for an actress?
Well, No More is a great piece of philosophy. I think it was more that looking for the songs that ask the biggest questions, you know, going back to the idea of the sublime. Even in art, the sublime was the big things in nature, the images from English paintings of mountaintops and glaciers and shipwrecks and huge storms, nature at its most splendid and spectacular. How can you find any more sort of big overt content in Sondheim than in No More? We disappoint, we disappear, we die, but we don't. The idea that you die, but you don't. That occurs in so much of his work, mm-hmm. even in, it's another place in A Miller's Son, you know, I'll not have been dead when I die. You know, this idea of death and not dying. But the big questions of No More are not things like as simple as like, how are things in Glacomora? You know, these are big, big issues. Similar in a way to his mentor, Oscar Hammerstein, who wrote, You've Got to Be Carefully Taught, mm-hmm. you know. So just big sublime things, the big questions, the big acts of nature, the big why are we here to suffer and die in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Why are
it
we
makes
here?
Makes me cry every time.
Yeah.
For that
why
reason.
Are we here to suffer and die in the first place? So I wasn't always so interested in all the little bickers, mm-hmm. the bickery songs that are bickering between people. I was looking for the places where he addressed the big, big philosophical questions. Children mm-hmm. will listen. Children in art, things like that. And I Believe I Remember actually is a weird, very specific, you know, to the Evening Primrose, but I Believe Even I Remember is a sort of a poem about everything we remember. Somebody's alarm is going off. It's time to wake up.
Far from this room.
No, maybe the listeners can't hear that, but someone's alarm just went off. Someone has to get up.
No, I have to say, by the way, on I Remember that I love seeing any kind of bringing Evening Primrose back. I never got to see it, but I feel like I hear so much about it.
I know.
As this like lost Sondheim gem that it's cool to hear a song from it.
Yeah. If nobody knows what that is, it's a perfect.
The craziest premise.
Craziest premise. And it is one of those things that also is kind of sublime about Sondheim, which is that he writes for extremely weird and specific circumstances. You could, even if it's, you know, Not While I'm Around, you know, from Tobias's song from Sweeney Todd, you know, how specific and strange can it get if it's a human pie, you know, it's a pie making company, and, you know, in London, these songs that were so specific and then become so universal. I Remember was written for a very particular and specific story. A girl has been locked in a department store since she was 6, and she has not seen the sky, trees, or as much as a leaf since she was a child. And she's been trapped so in this department store. And so she sings about a lost time and place. She sings about her past, in the song I Remember, but she uses all the words and the metaphors of a department store, things like umbrellas and parcels and ink and paper and anything you would see, vinyl, things that you, tablecloth, things you would see in a department store are the metaphors for her of the actual natural world. Mm-hmm. So, but somehow, in as weird as it is to get trapped in a department store, somehow that song is really about how we try to handle our losses. How do we try to restore our losses, you know, by by recalling them, you know? It's a poem about a lost time and world of sensation and feeling that's slipping away from all of our memories.
It's like the concept is like both bizarre and sort of romantic in a
way. And specific is what I'm saying. Specific and highly universal, though, somehow. Specific, but then universal, because we all can relate to that idea of a lost time. You know, so that's what's sublime about me, him to me, is that he writes so specifically to peculiar and specific things, and yet something really universal often comes out. You know, so that's weird and sublime. That's awe inspiring, right? Yeah,
no, I think
that's a mountaintop or a storm.
That awe inspiring is the right thing to say.
Yeah,
I wanted to talk to you about, which I think does ultimately relate back to Sondheim. I was really impressed by the op-eds that you've written for the New York Times in recent years about, you wrote one about the sort of difficult middle ground between being an ingenue in musical theater and being the like worldly older woman, and another about sort of the like addressing problematic things about female roles in classic musical theater, both of which predated this moment that we're in now, and I think we're sort of prescient in that way. And I encourage everyone to look them up on NewYorkTimes.com.
That first one, by the way, that was about aging. My, I told my agent, as you were saying, it's a little bit ahead of its time. I told my manager at the time, I said that I was approached by the Times to write a piece, and I think I was going to write about aging. And he said, "Well, do not put your age though in the paper." I was like,
but you did, and you survived to tell.
By the way, I didn't, because I'll tell you one little quirk about the New York Times is even if you write a 2,000-word essay, which I have now a couple of times, you don't write your own titles.
Oh, interesting. Oh, it's the headlines.
The headline. Yeah, the titles are not your domain. So whatever you write, someone else puts the big letters above it. It's funny, right?
Yep.
They're great at it, by the way. So
I have written New York Times stories, and I know exactly what you're dealing with.
So you know. It's weird, right?
And as a writer, you always have to tell people afterwards, I didn't come up with the headline if it's not something you like. But
if it's a little sketchy. So thank you.
Yeah, but those pieces were great, and I really dig into, I think, continually relevant topics in art in general, but in musical theater specifically. And I was curious, like, what inspired you to do those at that point, and has doing that changed how you look at the roles you take kind of going forward?
Has being able to write for the Times at all affected?
Just articulating what you did in those pieces, because I think you can sometimes work out thoughts that you've had for a long time when you write in a way that doesn't happen if you're just sort of ruminating on them.
Well, you're right, actually. That's one of the things. I've actually thanked the New York Times before for the opportunity to organize my emotions. Because writing and publishing in any way is – especially if you live turbulently, as actors do, we're always in response to this and that. We're passionate but powerless. It's such a difficult pursuit, especially for someone smart, never mind a woman. And not that I'm smart, but you know what I'm saying, but somebody thoughtful. I'm definitely thoughtful. I'm not skipping along. It sometimes can get confusing, you know, what to take, what to do, how to feel. And so having the opportunity to write really did help me organize organize my emotions about where I was in my career with aging and where women are in general. And the misogyny piece, I think, was just an excellent exercise because so many people were questioning where revivals fit in a modern world. You know, do we keep reviving these old shows, Kiss Me, Kate, et cetera, and all the Lerner and Lowe musicals? And I thought, whoa, I'm about to do one. So let me unpack and pack. So for 3 months, I kept notes and I watched myself pay attention to a classic role that could be, it is a bit misogynistic, you know, situation. A girl being hypnotized and the man is in love with her when she's hypnotized.
This sound was familiar? In A Clear Day.
This is in the musical On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever. I found my way in. I found my way into that by writing about it. And I was, I think, able to defend the play from being tossed out as a Alan J. Lerner exercise. You know, he was on his eighth wife at the time that he wrote it and so on. But I think there is a way to think about a lot of these characters. I think there's a few you can't do. I think a few revivals shouldn't be seen. But we didn't put those in the article. Those got cut at the last minute by one of my editors. He said, well, let's just not mention those. The idea behind my piece was to try to break down how sort of an actress would approach a character that could look like she's a victim, and how can you save it, and look for acts of agency, as they say, this new word agency. Anyway, I'm glad you liked it. I think it's an ongoing problem. You know, everyone would rather do all new musicals, but some of these musicals are great and just need some strong people behind them. So we don't perpetuate the wrong stories.
Well, I mean, for those reasons, I'm very interested to see the new Kiss Me, Kate next year, I think.
Yeah, I think it's coming out soon.
Yeah. And I mean, I recently had Laura Benanti on the podcast and we talked about My Fair Lady. And this My Fair Lady, as I think you noted also in one of your pieces, is really giving Eliza subtly a degree of agency that maybe she doesn't usually have.
By the way, we had it. That's in my piece. Yeah. And it was cut as we got closer to Broadway. The commercial producers continued to get rid of the feminist, really strong feminist radical things that a very radical British director who's now died, Howard Davies, he was way ahead of his time. And that was – and the New York Times fought for that information. They were very interested that when I did my Eliza Doolittle, the whole point was her her power and her sense of self. And it all got changed. My clothes were turned pink and purple. Everything was modified. Everything that was radical was changed in that era. People didn't want to see the darker side of that fairy tale. So times have changed. Yeah. So in some ways, I was in a transitional generation with a transitional. You know, I was a certain kind of a person as well. I was right out of college, really, really intellectual, really wanted to do it, really wanted that interpretation to happen. There was nothing I could do. I couldn't, and there's no internet where you could say, screw the producers, and I want to, and make it a bit of a fuss and fight for, you know. There's no way to be heard. We used to just get shut down. Actresses used to just get shut down. The dimensions of an artist, an actor, or a person's, you know, experience as an actor was, no one was interested in all those dimensions in the old days.
So. Well, I like you said, I mean, if you're a thinking person, I think that maybe you weren't treated as one in the past in the way that maybe you can be now.
Yeah, with your help and anyone else's, just to let me, I really, I've been teaching. I taught a master class all summer at HB Studios. I have lots of students now. And, the atmosphere at HB is electric, really. You know, people looking for role models, you know, places where they can ask questions and feel good about themselves. There's a lot of people go into show business and women very, very scared, very powerless, very feeling victimized before they've even begun, feeling afraid to have ideas. You know, I do think it's changing, but people like Laura Benanti are doing a good thing because she's a ebullient and outspoken and smart girl who knows exactly what she's worth, and she must be a wonderful collaborator. You know, it's not actually so bad to be a collaborator and not just a servant.
You know, no, that's a very good point. Speaking of collaboration, a very good segue. I wanted to hear before you go a little bit. We talked before the podcast about an exciting project you've been working on with a artist I really love, so maybe you can share with everyone a little bit about that.
Oh, I've been working on a lot of actual new musicals. I would hate to single out just one. I'm working with David Shire and Adam Gopnik on a musical, and we're doing that actually in January, I think 21st or 24th, one of those two, at 54 Below. That's a new musical called Table, and that's a beautiful, beautiful show. But I have done workshops and development readings for a bunch of new musicals, one which you and I share this great admiration for, Regina Spektor, and she has a musical named called Beauty, which is absolutely fascinating. Tina Landau did some workshops, and it's a fascinating poem, really, about beauty and power and a mother, a daughter, and the Sleeping Beauty myth sort of updated. I don't think I should say much more because I don't know how much they want talked about it, but Regina Spektor is another electric female who needs her voice on the stage.
Well, yeah. Fingers crossed. I would love to see that. She's like your compatriot and curly-haired woman.
She is a goddess. She is a goddess. There's a lot of goddesses out there, and we got to all unite.
Well, I think that also a really nice trend lately has been seeing more women creators and musical theater composers and directors, and seeing like all female creative teams.
And Georgia Stitt is an exciting woman, and obviously Sarah Bareilles, and just so many. I think you're right, and I do think there's a warmth, and that, you know, I noticed with my album coming out, people tweeting, Kristen Chenoweth tweeting, and Donna Murphy tweeting, you know, being supportive of me, I do believe that if we all hold hands, you know, we're gonna get far. And I think it's all happening. I'm optimistic. While the world seems troubled, I think that we can probably come out of this, you know, better, and definitely off better together.
That's an excellent note to end on. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you, Billboard.
Hey. But in time, nothing can harm you, not while I'm around. Melissa Errico's Sondheim Sublime is now out on Ghostlight Records. If you're a fan of the Billboard on Broadway podcast, please subscribe and give us lots of nice reviews on iTunes. You can find us on many platforms, including Spotify and Google Play. And you can find me on social media, on Twitter at Rebecca Milzoff, on Instagram at YaDownWithRMM. You can always use hashtag Billboard on Broadway if you would like to tweet or post anything about the podcast. And hope to have you back next week. Blah, 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 blah.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.